Easter Monday. Happy Easter to those who celebrate.
No, also the people that don't celebrate can have a happy Easter. Why are you only limiting it to the people that celebrate?
No, you can't have a happy... Sorry, you can have a happy Easter. You can't have a joyous Easter.
Okay. I'm going to do both.
You can only be happy. Max. I actually was growing up and just thinking about this right now. I was a huge fan of like the chocolate bunnies. Like that. No, I'm talking about like the cheap ones.
Oh, you like chocolate?
No, but like.
As a kid, you like chocolate.
No, but you know the like low quality ones? There's something about it. There's something about
it's
that.
Hard. It's like,
yeah, that particular like you had to work on it. You had it. It was basically, hey, you have this chunk of chocolate. You're going to be chiseling away at it for a couple of days.
And also, it was like sitting in the back at like the drugstore for like 11 months.
Yeah, exactly. The best is when you see those things and they go on sale immediately afterwards. They're like, you can just have this because it's been here for years.
Yeah.
Like
I haven't had any chocolate.
Neither have I. Actually, that's not true. I went to my grandmother's place on Saturday and she had mini eggs.
Mm-hmm. Cream?
No. That's Cadbury egg.
Okay.
Mini egg is the chocolate coated one.
Well, I mean,
hard
cream
shell.
Egg is also
no, hard shell. Not hard. No.
What? It's not, also hard. What are you talking about?
No, it's soft. It's chocolate. It's regular chocolate. It's like candy coated shell. That's what it is.
What is the mini eggs?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Nah.
Yeah, really? Oh no, I'm high on the mini eggs. Like those are addictive. Like you can't.
I feel like they're all in like very pastel colors.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. You feel like I feel as though no, they are. They just
why
are.
Why can't they just be like bright colors? Why does everything in Easter have to be like pastels?
I don't know. I don't know the history of pastels in Easter.
Is that like a thing Jesus was into? He's like, nothing too bright. My corneas get disturbed.
Yeah, he was like, please. Yeah. Please, guys, come on. He's like, we've been over this. That was actually most of what they talked about at the Last Supper. It was color schemes.
He's like, how about like a little brightness in your life, Jesus?
He's like, no.
Don't overdo it. Like, it's tasteful.
Yeah, that's it. He was like, don't be too showy.
Yeah.
don't be trying to show up me. Okay, so the Blue Jays played this weekend.
Oh, yeah. Sure did.
Yeah, they did for the first time. It was actually, I got to tell you, I always say that the first series of the year feels the most important until we get into fall baseball.
Yeah.
You agree?
Yeah, yesterday I felt like the season was on the line.
Okay, damn it. Okay, so I want to do today, the segment is Blue Jays snap judgments, okay?
Yes.
So it's just Blue Jays snap judgments. It's things that we feel in our gut, things that we watched from the first series the Toronto Blue Jays played that we feel deep in our bones are actually going to transpire over the course of the season or already are true. And one of the things that I actually have as my first Blue Jays snap judgment is, I'm stealing this bit from you, is... what do you call, you say...
Yeah, the must-win game as decided by me.
Yes, must-win game as decided by me. I didn't want to tweet it because there's too many people who are like, actually, and it's just not fun.
I should have done it.
But yesterday...
I didn't have internet. I had to watch I had to watch the game on my phone projected onto my TV, so I couldn't tweet at the same time.
Man, I used my Rogers Ignite, free plug for those guys. I used my Rogers Ignite when I was on the train on the way back from my visit, and I watched the Blue Jays game, and it was just delightful. Like, technology, having that ability.
Yeah. And, no, it's pretty amazing that on my Rogers phone, I was able to watch the game on my TV.
Yeah, that is, it's pretty, it's crazy.
Really good.
It's pretty crazy. No, but one of my biggest takeaways from the weekend was yesterday was a Ben Ennis must win game.
You're right.
Like
100%.
Imagine this scenario. They're 1-3 today.
Yeah.
Gausman didn't look good.
Yeah.
And what was that guy? Tyler Alexander?
Yeah.
That slop tossing, horrific. That guy has to be the worst pitcher in baseball. Like, I refuse. Yeah. They went, he's the bulk guy. I went, bulk in what way? Like, he's going to pitch.
He gives up bulk runs.
Yeah, he's, I've never felt.
No, but he was like Ryan Yarbrough incarnate. And Buck did a good job, like, of pointing out that those guys give the Jays
they did.
Fits
maybe because Yarbrough was name brand and he had been over some.
Off-brand Ryan Yarbrough.
Off-brand.
Not the same.
No, he was not the same. Anyways, it's like, when Isaiah Kiner-Falefa step into the dish and he's just like, I'm all over this guy. You know it's bad. You know it's really bad.
Yeah, to the tune of a single.
Yeah.
Two of them.
But they were red hot. They were red hot singles. They were were juicy singles. Yeah. Anyways, I thought that yesterday was a must win because if the Jays came out of that 1-3,
scoring no runs like they did in the middle two games. Three total over those two games.
Exactly. Had they had a game where they did not score runs and Gausman ended up losing and you were going into this series, it
must win with Bowden Francis on the hill.
It was a must-win game for the Toronto Blue Jays. And so the season is off to a good start. Who wouldn't have taken starting 500 against the Rays on the road?
You know what I like? My sneaky thing about baseball, too, and my feels and, like, how I feel good. This is like they didn't fritter away a win, too. It's like the losses were losses and the wins were wins.
I will say I didn't really appreciate that in the one game when they were only down three runs that John Schneider went to Wes Parsons, who I don't think we'll be on the team for very long. I was like, wow, you made the team? Like, who is that? What's the guy
with the minor league ERA last year approaching five? Yeah.
Okay, so I saw that they had to DFA Yosver Zulueta.
Yes.
Who at one point was like the savior. Yeah.
It was hot on the streets. People were like, Yosver, Yosver.
That's they really were. They were singing his name, Yosver.
Yeah.
I went, how bad are the guys behind Wes Parsons that they couldn't make the baseball team? Like, you're watching him, and it, like, just you shouldn't keep playing anymore. If you're over the age of 25 and you couldn't make the team over Wes Parsons, it should be like a wake-up call, reality call that it's done. Yeah. It's not happening for you.
Yeah, Wes Parsons, I believe, spent some time in Asia, whether it was Japan or the KBO. Okay. And, yeah, he's approaching 30 years old. And
yeah.
It's not his first foray into the major leagues of baseball, but it takes all sorts, right?
Don't you love that, though, when it's like, he's living his dream. It's just like, bang.
He only gave up one run, though, right?
Yeah, but it was
three runs. Three.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was definitely more than one. Yeah, I was like, I guess there was an error in there. I was like, he gave up the game. It was done. As soon as he stepped in there, it was like, the game is over.
Yeah, but like, here's what I do.
Why not just have a mercy rule then at that point? Like, why not have John Schneider go out there and be
Wes
like,
Parsons
hey.
Wes Parsons is the mercy rule.
No, but instead of playing it out, though, he's like, hey, just tack on three runs. Like, give them to whoever you want, whoever's struggling. Well, give them the stats.
The thing is, they don't allow you to put position players into games and in positions that close anymore. So, like, that's as close as you can get as a Wes Parsons. Reverse victory cigar, whatever you call that.
Yeah. White flag.
Yeah, it's white flag.
Bring out the white flag.
You know what I like, though?
Yes.
But they only scored two runs, right? So you're like, they were going to lose anyway.
I hate that. Yeah, I hate that.
They lose.
No, that was...
Defense was awful in that game.
Yeah, it really was. But there was definitely the reason part of... And like to close the loop on why yesterday was a must win is the two losses were way too familiar. That feeling of, well, you might as well bring in Wes Parsons because you're down three runs
and
like
score.
You'll never do that. Meanwhile, I watched the Dodgers play two nights ago or yesterday. They had two comeback wins. Where
Yankees,
it was like,
I think all four of their wins were comeback wins.
Yeah, but that was it. It was just like Mookie Betts hit a home run and then all their guys drove in runs and then Max Muncy steps up to the plate and you're like, oh my God, there's no let up.
Oh, right.
You're not out of these ball games. You can actually, it's like you're allowed to win down three runs. That happens in baseball. It's possible to do.
You know what? Like, everybody's memory is so short.
Yeah.
I remember these things.
Okay, what do you remember?
I remember April, them having some incredible comebacks. They had a series in Anaheim where it was like, oh my goodness, what an incredible at-bat again by Matt Chapman, who had 45 doubles, like just off the top of my head.
He's the greatest player who ever lived.
He literally, I think, set the franchise record for doubles in a month.
Yeah.
He was the best player in baseball.
Yeah.
He literally was the American League Player of the Month
in
April.
Yeah.
And Bo Bichette had a huge...
And he would never be again.
And Vlad had a great month of April, too, you will recall.
Yeah.
Because they played very few games at home. Because he didn't hit his first home run until the end of June. So, and I remember the Rays were off to the 13-0 start. Blue Jays handed them their first series loss of the season. First loss of the season? First series loss of the season. And then the wheels fell off subsequently. But April was good for this team a season ago. So before you start going nuts.
Well, no, I'm going nuts because today's Blue Jays snap judgments. Sure. Okay, so I have a lot more. So do you want me to keep going or you want to go?
I don't know. It's your show. You tell me.
No,
what to do.
I'm offering you. Either we can take turns, or I can kind of do some, and then you can do some.
Do you want me to do the thing that I'm most passionate about coming out of the weekend?
Yeah, yeah. What's your number one snap judgment?
I just did it with Joe Siddall, but like I feel I'm
so you're already doing the things.
Well, I'm going to keep doing it until
that's great.
Until I'm proven correct here or wrong.
Okay.
I feel like
snap judgment.
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. David Schneider is good and needs an opportunity to play every day. And it might be in left field because Dalton Varsho looks eerily similar to the guy that we've seen last year.
So this is just Ben and his confirmation bias hours. Like you were like,
Well,
because you bought all the David Schneider stock. You've already like heavily invested in this take that he's going to be like live up to his nickname.
Correct.
That he will be,
I don't call him Babe. I actually hate that nickname, Babe Schneider. I don't like it at all. No,
I do call him Babe now though.
Yeah, I know you. I don't like that.
But it's hard
like
not to.
No, it's really easy for me. I never do it. I've never done it in my entire life. No, I don't know. Okay. What are we doing here? It's like we just forget about the 35 games that he played last year, and it's like, oh, he had a couple of games where he struck out. Okay. It's okay, whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the guy wasn't going to have a 1,400 OPS. He's not likely to have a 1,000 OPS, but the process remains good. He doesn't swing it at balls, and when he gets a pitch that he's looking for in a hitter's count, he hits it super hard. Mm-hmm. And the path to playing time for him, I think, it's the toughest for any of the Blue Jays part-time players. Mm-hmm. Like Ernie Clement, and we can talk about, I think he's part of a shared snap judgment after the weekend
of baseball. I have a piggyback off this, yeah.
Yeah, but like you can see the path to playing time for Ernie Clement because of the defense. But for David Schneider, it's like, okay, well, the defense is obviously diminished from what Dalton Varsho brings in left field and second base. It seems like they're hell-bent on the Kevin Biggio second half thing being the real Kevin Biggio. So where does he play? And they have a full-time DH who's making $13 million. Mm-hmm. Where does he play? I think he's going to force their hand because I think he's legit good, like above-average offensive player who gets on base and hits home runs.
But this is the thing for you, is that he doesn't swing at bad pitches and he's got pop for the position. This is like the full premise based on those things.
Yeah. What else would you like?
No. I'm just curious. Like this is why.
But he does the thing that nobody else does, which is like, Ernie Clement is high as you can be on him. He's not a everyday major leaguer. Hasn't been because he doesn't take walks or hit for power. Like he's always hit for a high average. That's cool. And it's really cool if you do it to the degree of Ichiro Suzuki. But if you're not Ichiro or Luis Arraez, you got to hit for power, which Davis Schneider does. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why they seem to think that Dalton Varsho is going to be able to do that better than Davis Schneider. Obviously, it's like there's more to his game than that. Yeah. But like I could see. So if it's not going to happen at second base, like. And there's another snap judgment that ties into this that we can talk about.
That's next, yeah. The piggyback off this is that I don't think that Isaiah Kiner-Falefa is going to be the team's everyday third baseman or that he's going to play as many games as we initially prognosticated when looking at this roster. Like, he doesn't make that much money, okay? It's not a Justin Turner, you make $13 million thing, right?
He's going to be on the roster.
Yeah, he's on the roster, and he'll play third base primarily when he is playing. But my snap judgment was they're going to find creative ways to get Ernie Clement in there because the bat-to-ball thing is just very real, and they're going to find ways to make sure that, they get Davis Schneider in, and I think one of those ways is to give him, looks at that position potentially as well.
I don't know if I see Schneider playing third base.
Sorry, infield two and then kicking over and playing Ernie three and making sure that there are guys that are, even Kevin Biggio playing third base.
Yeah. I mean, I would take it a step further and say that, like, give me Ernie Clement everyday third baseman right now.
Already,
Isaiah Kiner-Falefa.
Yeah, then I'm with you. Okay, here's how I'm taking Blue Jay snap judgment. The Isaiah Kiner-Falefa.
You soft-pedaled it. Come on.
The Isaiah Kiner-Falefa signing is bad already, and they really didn't need him. Like, they had Isaiah Kiner-Falefa on the team, and his name was Ernie Clement, and it was totally fine, and you didn't need to spend $7 million.
Agreed.
Yeah. The guy with the career OPS plus of 85 or whatever that has shown no signs of ever hitting the baseball.
Don't give him 85. He's 81.
He's 81? Okay, yeah. The guy who's never shown signs ever of hitting any baseballs despite playing in ballparks where you're allowed to hit the baseball. He's not going to all of a sudden hit the baseball on a team that shouldn't have a bottom three of just corpses, and he's possibly one of those. Yeah. And I need a 30 for 30 deep dive. Next time we have Robert Murray on, I need the executives that said that he's the signing of the offseason to name, like, if I was a baseball fan and I found out that my executive said, hey, difference between, hey, that's a good depth signing, and signing of the offseason, and this is a snap judgment for me too. I think that front offices are way too obsessed with, like, getting a deal on a guy, you know, like they're like all of us. Everybody wants a deal, right? Yeah. You buy a shirt and they go like, it's 15% off and you like that shirt so much more because you want to tell people, hey, I got this shirt for cheaper. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Blue Jays kind of look at Isaiah Kiner-Falefa and went, hey, if you look at his war compared to Chapman from the last 3 months and the fact that we only paid him $7 million and he got this, like I think that there's an obsession with that.
I've seen the defense and it's fine.
It's not, okay.
Ernie Clement might be the better defender. We're just learning about Ernie Clement. Both guys can play shortstop, but Ernie Clement can play shortstop.
If you're going to be that bat, I need you to be Andrelton Simmons. Like, I need you to be like Sterling, where every game you go, oh, well, he made that play and it saved a run. And Isaiah Kiner-Falefa had one where he like booted it, and I went, know. You can't boot it ever. You can you can have, your limit for boots. That was it. That's the end.
Yeah. Well, you got to go.
Is that soft pedal? Is that, okay, no, there's the true, that's the true snap judgment. I can't stand him already. I was like, oh my God, please, no. Like, this guy's a nightmare.
And I feel like I've been put in this position because I started in this position with IKF. I feel like I've been put in this position with Ernie Clement because I'm not as high on Ernie Clement as anybody was coming into the season.
No.
Because, again, I look at the minor league numbers. I'm like, yeah, this guy hits for pretty high average, but no walks and no power. So that's fine. So, like, what's the best optimistic projection? Is it he hits, like, 270 with, like, a 700 OPS? But, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's better than Isaiah Kiner-Falefa's entire career. Mm. And defensively, early returns, like Ernie Clement better. Plus, he's a Buffalo guy, like that too.
Yeah, like he's got the nickname. He's got, you know what?
Does he have the nickname? People calling him Big Earn?
I think we, well, maybe that's just us.
I want it. Because I've never, all I want is to be a guy that puts somebody's nickname on Best
like
Baseball Reference.
Oh no, but like, I
what?
Well, I gave Alec Manoah when I had him on. I was like, the people that are fans are you, I'm naming the Manoans.
Manoans, that's good.
And then
good,
he went to the podium after his first start and was like, the Manoans were loud out there. And I went, this is incredible.
Good. That's good.
This is great.
See, something tangible. I want the baseball reference. And the thing I keep going to is like Mike Wilner got Scott Downs snake face, like is on his baseball reference page. Snake face as his like official nickname because people didn't like Scott Downs because he didn't have like an intimidating presence. And he's like, what, do you wish he had like a tattoo of a snake on his face?
Well, okay, but I will say this though. This is an unfair thing because if you were to do it, it would be such a bigger accomplishment than someone who was a broadcaster of the team.
Oh, yes.
Because if you're
nobody.
No, but that's, no. It's not that. It's that if you're a broadcaster of the team and you just say it on air, it's done.
Yeah, you're right.
Like you've decided it. You actually have that. Yeah. All broadcasters have
that's
like
true.
If Dan Shulman tomorrow wanted to be like, and oh, look at Bambi out here. Oh, here comes Bambi. People will be
that's
like, I guess he's called Bambi.
That, you should wield more mightily, or at least I would.
Yeah, and people will be like, do you know?
Oh, chicken legs out here.
Yeah, that's it. So it's like, you can start that.
Yeah.
No, but you know what I love about Ernie Clement, too?
It has to be Big Earn.
When there's like young, young baseball, right? Minor league baseball, not minor league, youth baseball.
Yeah.
There's always like the little skinny, scrawny kid who can field his position well and always like makes contact. And he's like the coach's son.
Yeah.
You know, like there's one kid on the travel team who's like, hey, this guy's, he's one of our best, most skilled guys. He's the guy who has the bat to ball. He runs, he does everything right. And he fits in with the team and he's a good guy. And he's been playing ever since he was a little tiny kid. And Ernie Clement just reeks of that. Like he's on the on the little league team. That's it. He's the little league coach's son.
But that's annoying if he stinks.
Yeah, but no. But those guys don't normally stink. That's what I'm saying. They're good, but they never have the projection of being like, oh, if this guy was actually in a more athletic body, oh, if this guy was actually stronger,
can you
bigger.
Imagine being Ernie Clement and looking over at Isaiah Kiner-Falefa making whatever, like $500,000.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, no, that makes sense.
No, because
life is fair.
Yeah,
for
life
sure.
is okay. Yeah, yeah. Actually, no, here's the thing, though. It would be good for me because I would be reminded that, man, if I could just stick around and I could just be 81 OPS plus.
Yeah.
If I can just be 81 OPS plus, someone's going to hand me like life-changing money.
He's 28, though, is the problem there.
That is a bit of a problem. That is a bit of a problem in terms of getting paid.
He's not arbitration eligible until next year and not a free agent until 2029.
Yeah. That'll be difficult.
That'll be a rough one for him. So the $7.5 million IKF contract probably not coming to Ernie Clement.
No.
But more reason to say Ernie.
But,
Big Earn.
Yeah, I already know that IKF in big spots, this is the snap judgment to close, is that when he comes up in big spots, it's going to piss me off. The only Big Earn thing is that because he is such a ball and play guy, he's going to hit into so many double plays and be frustrating too.
Like maybe the fastest guy on the team. This was, I think it was Arden that alerted me to this fact. Like, his sprint speed literally...
He's faster than Varsho?
Yes. Mm. He's the fastest guy. Varsho's base running is, like, not just his speed. Yeah. Like, he's just a really good base runner which we've seen. He went first to second on that pop-up in foul territory over the weekend.
Yeah. He's smart.
I was like, oh, my God, he's on second base.
Dude,
well,
Varsho's a weird guy where when he's on the bases, you're like... Dude, you're so enjoyable.
Yes.
Like, you're actually so enjoyable on the bases. The problem is he doesn't get there enough. And here's another snap judgment. This is a mini one that I didn't have prepared. I'm done with Dalton Varsho bunts, okay? Like, funny. I know it was effective, but when there's runners on and you're in the cleanup spot, you're the five hitter. No. Like, I don't want to see bunting anymore. I want to, swing away. You know, the movie Signs? That's it. Hey, swing away.
Right into the face of that alien. Yeah.
Anyway,
swing the bat at the alien's face.
Swing the bat. Take the bat off your shoulder.
Spoiler warning. Yeah. But to me, I had a snap judgment that's kind of similar. It was like, this guy's already terrified that it's going pear-shaped. Like, he is not at all confident in the changes he made in the offseason. And it's one thing to, like, hey, against the lefty starter, like, you try it once a game. Mm-hmm. I feel like every at-bat, or like half of the at-bats, he's trying to lay down a base hit bunt. And you mentioned it in an RBI spot yesterday, the runner on third base with two outs. He's trying to come up with the base hit bunt. It's alarming.
I just don't like the bunt thing. It's just, I get it. It's worked for you in the past and it's been fine, but I'm not into it.
Yeah. I got another
your snap judgment,
snap right, judgment your on another one of the outfielders.
Yeah.
The guy that didn't play yesterday.
Yeah.
We didn't talk enough about Kevin Kiermaier's offensive season being an outlier last year. Like, that he's never really been that guy over the course of an entire season playing that many games. He had an OPS plus of 104 at the age of 33, playing 129 games in elite defense. We didn't talk enough about him and the not probable, like, likely regression of his offense. Like, he still plays, like, but the idea that he's closer, like, that you might have two Dalton Varshos in your outfield right now, like, is very much in play. Like, when... Remember the conversations we were having about Kevin Kiermaier when he signed as a free agent last year? And they're like, oh, well, it's fine. He's going to be the fourth outfielder because, like, his offense doesn't really play. And he's like, no, I've been assured, like, I got an everyday job. We're like, what? Mm-hmm. And then he backed it up with his play. And you're like, holy cow, yeah. No, I'm happy with that guy. He's the ninth hole hitter. Well, part of that also is he's not hitting ninth anymore because of the weakness at the bottom of this order. He has to play higher than the ninth, or I guess they like the Kevin Biggio walk potential at the bottom of the lineup. Anyways. Yep. The offense that you got out of Kevin Kiermaier, that might not be coming back this year. It's likely not to come back at the age of 35 playing the offense or the defensive workload that he's asked to carry on turf.
Yeah, so you don't listen to my show when you're in the car. You listen to other podcasts.
I do sometimes, but I get a lot of calls.
No, but I actually have. When you said we didn't talk enough, I actually have been. I brought this up quite a bit where I went.
Really? I didn't talk about it.
Yeah, it was like positive, negative regression, guys. There's all this discussion about positive regression, but one of the big things was they got quite a bit out of Kiermaier to the tune of, for a while, he was the nine hitter and he was the best nine hitter in all of baseball.
Yep.
That's what they were getting from him.
Had the only RBI in the two-game postseason series.
And so when I was looking at positive and negative regression guys, we were doing, hey, positive for Kirk and positive for Varsho and positive for Bo and Vladdy and Springer. But no, he was a notable negative regression guy offensively. My thing is, I don't believe they're going to lean on him as much this year. I think that what they're going to do is exactly that, which is kick Varsho over to center and find more time for your boy, David Schneider. And also find more time for Kevin Biggio, because here is my Blue Jay snap judgment. Mm-hmm. I actually have more respect for Kevin Biggio's game, like his ability to hang around the majors. This is a guy I wrote off many times.
Yeah.
I've probably written off Kevin Biggio a conservative 48 times where I've just gone, I don't want to see it anymore, right? Kevin Biggio up at the plate where there's runners in scoring position and he won't swing the bat and he's just, guys start pumping strikes and they go, oh, right. In fact, I would say it's almost as frustrating, weirdly, to have watched pitchers walk him in certain spots where you go, hey, man, all you needed to actually do was throw him strikes. I can't believe that you were trying to throw him weird breaking stuff off the plate. That's exactly what he wanted from you because the book was so obvious. But now I'm just kind of, I watched Kevin Biggio over this weekend and he drew what, three walks? Yeah, I think he had three walks, three RBIs. He hit a home run in the first game. He's respectable at the dish. He can play multiple positions. He's not what we had hoped that he was going to be. You know, plus at all of those positions, but I just think that he's a plus on the roster. And when you're talking about like guys that can be at the bottom of the order, and when they put him in that nine hole and they say, you can actually get on base for when the lineup turns over.
Yeah.
I like that for him. All respect for Kevin Biggio. It's a snap judgment. I feel maybe part of it is that they've had so many bad guys, and part of it is even more of an Isaiah Kiner-Falefa effect where I'm like, this guy over you. But respect to Kevin Biggio. Think that he's developed like a nice little career for himself.
Yeah. Going town to town.
Yeah.
No, I got a lot of time for Kevin Biggio. I don't think that he's infallible. I think the organization does value him too much. Like, they don't...
Schneider loves him.
I think they want to play him, like, every day against lefties. Like, given their druthers, they're like, this guy's an everyday player. But I'm like, no, Davis Schneider needs to play. Like, if you're not playing Davis Schneider at second base against lefties, where are the starts going to come? And you're right. Like, maybe you can only afford one of Dalton Varsho and Kevin Kiermaier in the lineup at one time, and so left field ends up the Davis Schneider position, but this team seems so leveraged on defense, and I guess I don't know enough about Davis Schneider in left field to say that he's a significant negative. I think compared to Dalton Varsho, he will be.
Sure.
But I don't think that they're too pleased with left field being the landing spot for Davis Schneider. I mean, ideally, I think they want to play him at the DH, but they got a 40-year-old guy making $13 million.
Sure, either way, play Davis at second base and play Cavan in left field. Like, you know, there's ways of doing this where both guys can play and you don't need as much from, Kevin Kiermaier, who I don't think they're going to need as much. The only thing that I would say, it's not troubling, but if you're projecting the idea of less Kiermaier this year, is he publicly came out and talked about how the Jays coveted him and the Jays promised him playing time.
Yeah, you know why nobody wanted to give him the money and the term that he wanted is because they're like, the mid-30s guy who had one of the best years of his career offensively and was just a barely above average offensive player, but that was good considering all-time great glove in center field. But they're like, no, we're not giving you 2-3 years at, you know, $15 million per. It's just not happening. Yeah. And so, of course he loves the Blue Jays, that there was a soft landing spot for him, but it's not ideal for him to be signing a one-year deal considering the season he had.
Blue Jays snap judgment, my next one.
Okay.
Vladimir Guerrero Jr. remembered that he has an elite eye, and the thing that actually is going to make him special, being selective at the plate with the pitches, is going to re-unlock top 10 MVP ballot Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
Okay, see, I had the opposite.
5 walks.
I like it.
4 hits and a bomb. And to me, the most significant thing was he never looked like he was really pressing at the plate, and that to me is the biggest sign of positivity from the entire Blue Jays weekend, is just that this guy kept taking big pitches and good pitches.
Yeah.
Okay, you're still going to go negative, okay?
And he hit one over the fence.
Yep.
Like a cement mixer breaking ball.
Yep, and it was one of the...
Sick.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, wait, so you didn't cry about the fastballs?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's the most important thing. It was the thing that kept him from having a good year a season ago was like, it's cool to get into hitters' counts and take walks, and took nearly 100 walks in that 2021 season. Mm-hmm. Having a 400 on base is super valuable, and a thing that I thought was like
the only guy that was like going to be with him. Do 5 walks and you're going to be negative. Normally, walks is your favorite thing. You'd rather see a walk.
I'm not negative. I'm just saying he hasn't shown me anything yet.
Okay. All right. Ooh, wow. All right.
Hit a fastball.
All right.
Because in that same game that he hit the cement mixer 450 feet, which I got to believe was longer than 450 feet. You don't hit it over the batter's eye at the drop, and that's only 450 feet.
I thought the same thing where I went, are we sure about how this system works if that's what they said it was?
I feel like the Red Sox fans, after Rowdy Tellez hit the ball further than Ted Williams, they're like, no!
Yeah.
I'm like, nah, 450, not actually how far that went. That was great. Yeah. And that's what you should do with the cement mixer breaking ball. But the problem he had last year was punishing the pitches that I'm so high on Davis Schneider for punishing, like the middle up fastballs in hitters counts. Don't just like flare those to right field. Cause in that same game, first game of the season, he got one of those in a hitters count. They hit it really hard. Minus like 500 launch angle to right field, ground out to first base. Right. So like hit the fastball. Cause that's this team's problem was hitting fastballs last year in elite velocity. So hit a fastball. It's good. Like, you know me, I love walks. I'm not going to say it's bad. And it's not, you know what? It's not a Kevin Biggio situation where it's like, you're getting passive and eventually teams are going to catch on and throw you some fastballs and you're going to have to swing the bat. I actually like this as the approach that Vlad's taking out of the gate and it's like showing the world. It's like, I won't be swinging at everything. I won't be swinging at your borderline pitches. You got to come to me. But then when that happens, like you have to park it. Mm-hmm. And also, just going back to a season ago, again, everybody's memory is so short. And nobody remembers the conversations we were having about Vlad figuring it out in the first month of the season to the tune of an 885 OPS and a ton of walks. And he hit 5 home runs. He had 13 walks, 14 strikeouts in the month of April in 28 games. And then it all fell apart. So, no, it's not a bad sign, but I'm not yet convinced.
That's fine. And I will tell you that the whole point of this is not a smart guy segment. This is a clear dumb guy segment. This is, you and I have always said this. We want to bring back conversations in baseball that are just, hey, this is how you feel.
Look like a ball player.
Yeah, this is how, because that's fun with sports. What isn't
David
fun?
David Schneider looks like a ball player.
What isn't fun is breaking down everybody's woba all the time and being like, "Oh well, his woba is like woba. Okay." I don't want to hear.
To say woba.
It is fun to say woba, but that's what that fun ends. The fun ends with the word. That's it. I want to have these kind of talks where you go, "I feel this in my plums." Like I love this about a series in baseball, and especially this 4 games when the season starts and you get to do this stuff. That said, Blue Jay snap judgments. Daniel Vogelbach won't be on this team in a month.
Yeah, because this is the Daniel Vogelbach experience.
Yeah, he is already gone.
Daniel Vogelbach in this city before. Seen Daniel Vogelbach. People would be like, what? Yeah. Daniel Vogelbach. Yeah. He's been around.
I can't wait for Daniel Vogelbach to be on like the Brewers and he rakes for a month. And every Blue Jays fan's like, why did we let go of Daniel Vogelbach? That's going to happen. That's
Daniel Vogelbach. Yeah.
He's going to have an amazing month with the Cincinnati Reds.
Yeah.
And people are going to be looking at it.
No, the Brewers feels right because that's also the Rowdy Tellez team.
Yeah, yeah, that's
why he got off to a great start. And then, you know what? He became Rowdy Tellez again.
Yeah, he did.
And, you know, 50% of the trade return starting tonight in Houston, Bowden Francis.
No, you know what? He,
Trevor Richards.
Pirates.
You killed that trade initially, but it was a good one.
Yeah.
Like initially, Trevor Richards was manna from heaven. Imagine a bullpen in which Trevor Richards and Adam Simber are the saviors, but that's what we were dealing with at the time of that trade. And then Bowden Francis, I mean.
Yeah, that would be huge. Yeah,
if he's a rotation.
If he's a real guy, which I think he is.
Also, did you see Austin Martin made his major league debut over the weekend?
Hold on. I actually have a thing. I didn't see that. How was it?
0-3.
Yeah. Whatever. So he had one game. Yeah,
he got into a game as a defensive replacement or a pinch runner or something, and then he started yesterday for the first time. He went 0-3. But yeah, this is a guy. He's hitting ninth. I think he's being forced into major league action because they're like, this is the fifth overall pick. This is our Jose Barrios equivalent, who's starting on opening day and looking nails for the Blue Jays. Like, he's got to be something. I got news for you. He's nothing.
Oh, my God. He's nothing. Okay, that's so funny. Here's my next snap judgment. This doesn't have to do with the Blue Jays so much as it... Well, it has to do with the Blue Jays, but it wasn't from their game. Blue Jays snap judgments.
Uh-huh.
I thought I was ready to turn the page on trades and decisions.
Oh.
I'm still obsessed with the Blue Jays that aren't here. And it's because they forced me to pay attention. Okay. Teoscar Hernandez. 6 hits, 3 bombs, OPS plus of 154 to start the season in 24 ABs, just like crushing the baseball. Mm. Lourdes Gurriel Jr., 3 bombs, 10 ribbies, 315
that
OPS.
That doesn't count. When you start your season in Colorado against the Rockies, it doesn't count.
Okay. I'm just saying that those guys hit a lot of... Yeah. They hit 6 home runs combined.
No. Your take going into last season is the correct one. Last 2 off seasons ago, where it's like if you just
they overcorrected,
kept it,
yeah.
If you just didn't do anything, just don't do anything.
Yep.
You're doing too much.
If they had not done anything, they probably hang in a World Series banner.
Well,
I'm just have to be a little bit over the top with it. But no, I just to me again looking back, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I really believe that what they really got wrong was the fun quotient, is that they thought there would be like a maturity to the team by removing a couple of guys. And in actuality, it was like, nah, you actually need to be a fun baseball team in order to be an effective baseball team. And turning it into like the professional slog is only going to hurt these guys. And that's sort of what happened here. But I'm still obsessed with what Gabriel Moreno is doing. He had 4 RBIs. And again, you're right. Those ones don't count. But then this was the other one. This was the actual, and I watched a chunk of this. Like I had it on and I watched him pitch. Jordan Hicks versus the Padres.
Yeah.
Hold on. 5 innings pitched, 6 K, 0 earned runs. And he didn't get that much more than Yariel Rodriguez.
No. He wanted a rotation. He wanted to start, though, right?
Yeah.
And that was the thing. And we've seen that backfire on plenty of teams before. Like Daniel Bard, like his career was upended.
Yep.
Because the Red Sox tried to turn him into a starter, and then somehow, like by miracle of miracles, refigured it out and became an effective reliever again. But yeah, it wasn't about the money for that dude, and good on him, at least in early returns. But like in spring, he was one of the stories. It's like, oh my God, this guy looks terrifying. And the Blue Jays just they couldn't guarantee him a rotation spot, right? Because they were like, Alec Manoa, we got to at least open the possibility of him returning to form. And if he shows anything, if he had been healthy, he would have been in this rotation, plus Bowden Francis. Like, they had too many guys.
Yeah, I think he has a little bit of David Price to him in the sense of no matter what he does, you're going to be able to point to those things.
Yeah.
But also, if Manoa doesn't work out, then it almost looks like a little silly to just say, hey, we'll give you some runway here. We'll give you the fifth starter spot and see if he can earn his way back and then let the other guys push you out if it ends up happening. Anyways, and then, Matt Chapman, two home runs.
I agree,
but all I'm saying is between Teoscar Hernandez, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., and Matt Chapman, they had eight home runs an opening weekend. So it was just a reminder that I'm still a little obsessed with those guys and that it's going to take some time before I'm making the comparisons, and by time I mean like years.
Yeah.
Years.
I didn't know we were allowed to do outside of the Blue Jay snap judgments.
But that's because this is connected. It's very connected. We talked about IKF and the money he's making, and before
we talk about a guy that we're gonna see next weekend then?
No. That's not a snap judgment. No, it's not.
Then Juan Soto's going to be the
show.
Best.
No, save it for your show. Save it for your show. Okay. If you're snap judgments is Randy Rosarena has now replaced Gerrit Cole as the Blue Jays' number one villain and killer. He's the guy in all of baseball.
I would have said Yandy Diaz is more that guy.
Rosarena for me. He makes that incredible play in the field. There's something about him when he steps up to the plate. Like, I just feel like he's going to make it. Yeah, he's the number one Jays villain.
No, I know, but this counts. Okay, we can talk about Rays because I have one on Jose Caballero, who it's like you lose Wander Franco, who's like the cornerstone pillar of your franchise going forward. You paid him. You pay nobody.
Uh-huh.
And you lose him for like forever. And then you get this like near 30-year-old guy off the scrap heap who looks like he's a legit major leaguer and like kind of tortured the Blue Jays. And as a result of him running into Yennis Cabrera, you're going to be without him for three games. And that's a snap judgment because it's only four games. But that they found something in Jose Caballero, who's a nobody, but like on the Rays, he's a somebody.
Mm-hmm. Hey, on the Rays, everybody's a somebody except I think that the Rays turning over their pitching year over year and going, we can find pitchers. I think it's done.
I hope you're right.
First of all, just the two guys they had opening the season for them.
Yeah.
I went, that's who you got?
No, I know.
Savali is two.
Yeah.
You're in an opener in game four, and the bulk guy is the worst pitcher I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It feels like they have now hit a point of diminishing returns with the pitching from start to finish. Even the bullpen guys, the late inning guys that they brought in, they used to be, oh my God, everybody throws 100 and everybody's nasty. Everybody throws 100 with nasty breaking stuff.
Fairbanks is still good and Adam is still good.
Sure, good. I'm just saying they're not a terrifying, the game is over bullpen anymore. They don't have the nasty long guys anymore. And their starting pitching looks thin, more thin than it has in the past.
No, it's, I mean, you shouldn't be able to lose.
You really didn't feel the Randy Rosa. I think you're dead wrong. I guarantee you that, like, I'm putting this out there actually as a poll is like, who are you most afraid of the dish?
I'm a little gun shy because when he arrived on the scene in the postseason, I mean, you had legitimate conversations about who you would trade for Randy Rosarena.
I would still to this day trade the entire Blue Jays roster
like
for
Randy. Have a 30 homer season in a career.
If you told me who he was based on what I've seen of him, which is like killing Team Canada, killing the Blue Jays, that playoff run, I would trade
and the stolen base stuff and the speed and like, the excitement too. Yeah.
They'd be like, all of the Blue Jays roster for Randy Rosarena, I'd be like, we're getting a deal.
I know, but like then you have to look at the baseball reference page and you're like,
Yeah, but that's the weirdest thing is he's the number one guy that when I watch doesn't match up with the full body of season baseball reference. I'm like, how is this even possible?
No, how are the Rays even possible? How are they even in the conversation having Shane McClanahan, Drew Rasmussen, Shane Baz, Taj Bradley all injured for them?
Yeah.
No, it makes no sense.
It doesn't.
But it's never made sense.
No, I think guess what? I think it's going to make sense this year.
I hope you're right.
It's going to start to make a little bit of sense.
Please.
Yeah.
Like just law of averages. You figure there's some sense to be made at some point.
Yeah. All right. You got anything else?
I think I may have hit all mine.
Okay. I got one last one. George Springer is the biggest X factor of this Blue Jays team.
Okay, I thought you were going to do it. You got a little gun shy because we talked about one of yours and how I was going to go against it.
Which one?
The Bo defense one.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I didn't really love Bo's defense from the opening, but I think that that's one where it's not a snap judgment. I've never liked Bo's defense.
He committed 3 errors in the first 9 games last year in the same conversation. Yeah. We do this. He has like early season defensive issues.
Yeah. But to be fair, the one error that he was charged with was totally on Vladdy.
Yeah. Yeah.
The throwing error.
That's a long, like you got to make that.
Yeah. You got to,
If you consider yourself a
also, they
defensive.
Charged, who did? They charged it. Was it Kikuchi with an error on a bunt where it was like the infield single and they were like, it's an error? I went, that's really harsh. That was not
I don't remember. Did he advance a second?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, then that's.
Yeah. It was very strange. I wonder if they corrected that one. Anyways, I just, Bo's opening weekend defense wasn't exactly inspiring, would you say? Like,
no, but again, like I've seen the early season slumps.
Who cares? Back to the Springer thing.
Yeah.
That was my snap judgment. This wasn't it. See?
No, I know. You know, I thought you were being a coward. I thought you were being a coward.
You actually kind of violated the trust that I have for you in saying that.
I thought you were being a coward.
I thought that conversations that we have off air are not, the audience isn't privy to that.
Okay.
The audience is not privy.
I should have brought that to
but
the
now they know. No, I just, I watched Springer and he's hitting those home runs and I went, all of this season is going to come down to. Like we all made it about Vlad, rightfully so, right? Because he's the future and he's the biggest conversation guy. But if they're going to win this year, there's no path to me without George Springer being a 850 plus OPS guy who hits for power in the leadoff spot and sets the tone with big at-bats. And that's how I feel about this team is that he is after Vladdy because Bo is Bo, right? Yeah. I don't think anybody believes that Bo isn't going to be who we expect him to be.
Yeah, well soon.
But George Springer is the most important X factor to this team's to this team all year long. And monitoring what he's doing at the plate, his body language, his health, his power, there's nothing more important outside of what they get from Vlad.
Yeah, I don't disagree. It's interesting also that he's DH 4 games into the season with Justin Turner. We're told, like, he's not going to play the field. Are you crazy?
Yeah.
Justin Turner's already played third base twice in 2 separate games. Now, only started once.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the more the IKF thing rears its ugly head and the more you feel like you need to get George Springer off his feet, and maybe the more you want to find at-bats for Davis Schneider and there's no clear path for it, it'll be interesting to see how much third base, because, like, you don't care about chewing up Justin Turner's legs for next season. He's on a one-year deal, but you wonder how much third base he's going to play.
I don't think that much.
Yeah.
I don't. I think, again, one was the start where they took a little peek, and then the other one, he's coming in late because they needed the bat. Yeah. And to me, that'll if you look at games played at third base at the end of the year for Justin Turner, my guess would be that the majority of them are not starts.
Yeah.
They're exactly what we saw this weekend where he's coming in to pinch hit, and then he closes the game playing third, and they're saying, God, we're behind. We need this to happen. Mm-hmm. It's like in the playoffs for the Leafs. I don't think that Max Domi is going to play up on the top line. But I do think that when they're trailing in hockey games, he's going to get more ice time, and you're going to go, oh, he played top 6 minutes. Yeah, they were trailing. They had nothing to lose.
No, but your Springer point is valid because I've talked about, hey, what that 89-win Jays team looks like with Vlad being a 900 OPS guy and how that's like 3 or 4 wins. Yeah, if George Springer is like his average is George Springer last year, it's basically the same difference. He was a league average hitter. This is a guy that's World Series MVP, of course, right? And we've seen him at the peak of his powers at times carry this offense and then get injured.
Yeah.
And he was healthy. It's like, pick your poison. Do you want the guy who is like on the verge of being injured for half the year, but elite, or the guy who's always around, but like not that good?
Yeah.
I think I want the elite guy.
Yeah, elite. Well, and the thing I think that there's real proof of concept with this too is if you remember was it 2021 where he had all the injuries or 2022? It was, he's had 2 years where he was hurt, but after those 2 seasons
told he wasn't hurt.
But when he accumulated those 2 seasons of injuries and you looked at the Jays record with Springer versus without, it was startling.
Yes.
And so I view it same way as this year is you need him to be that guy again who actually drives things for you.
Well, and factually, nobody's going to get as many plate appearances as George Springer.
Because
as long as he's on this team, it does feel like, although he was away from the leadoff spot for a second and was Whit Merrifield for a second.
No, but then
back up
did you read Blair's column from last week?
Yes.
He had some line in there that was, and they're never going to move George Springer out of the leadoff spot because he'll be pissed.
Yeah.
He will not handle that
No, so you can't have the guy taking the most plate appearances being a league average hitter.
Yeah. Anyway, last snap judgment, and this one is very obvious, but I think that the bullpen is going to be a pretty major point of conversation over the next couple of weeks.
Like in a negative way?
They're without, and that's natural because they're missing three key guys.
Yeah.
In fact, we keep talking about it as though it's only two. It's like, no, they're missing three key guys because Yariel Rodriguez is supposed to have like an important function for them.
Sure.
But no, I don't. It feels as thin as I expected it to.
It's funny. I actually feel the opposite way. I was like, to lose as many guys as they had, like, there's enough guys that I don't feel horrible when they get into a baseball game.
No, I'm not saying it's horrible because you're right. They do have enough guys. There is depth, right?
They lost their closer in their setup, man. And Chad Green, like, pretty good. And, like,
yeah,
Jimmy Garcia, he can get the job done. And I know Yenesis Cabrera was DFA'd by the Cardinals. And yeah. He wasn't the guy that we saw in Toronto when he was in St. Louis last year, but like what we saw in Toronto was pretty amazing.
When they're going to be fully healthy, they're going to be one of the best bullpens in all of baseball. I hope, anyways, assuming that those guys come back and they are themselves.
And they are bullpens, so like they're very year to year, so
correct.
Variable.
All I'm saying is it's a snap judgment. It's how my gut felt.
Yeah.
My gut felt when
I respect your snap judgment.
When all of these guys came in their spots, and it's natural because they're all bumped up. They're all in positions that they kind of shouldn't be in.
Yeah.
I didn't feel comfortable at any moment.
Yeah. I feel like Tim Mayza just gets no respect for the reliever he's been and how dominant he's been. And Trevor Richards, remember, we were having legitimate conversations about Trevor Richards and leverage last year, and he's able to go multiple. And there's just like there's nobody, and even, oh, my goodness, Mitch White, doing the Mitch White thing?
I mean, part of it was that Mayza gave up the run, and I went,
yeah.
It was just one, but yeah. Anyway, I'm just saying that, Chad Green gave up the bomb. I don't know. I didn't feel super confident. The guy I felt good about was Garcia, but that was because the broadcast went, these guys feel as though Garcia matches up
against
and I went,
Rays.
I'm sold. You guys are smart. You guys are
swing bats and
I was like, they know way more than I do. So I felt that's the power of suggestion, really. Is Shulman goes, they love how he matches up, and I'm like, and then he got those outs, and I went,
that's right,
hell yeah,
yeah.
So
the machine is right,
but no, yeah, Chad Green in that spot. And
that was the same machine that told them to pull Jose Barrios in the fourth inning, though.
Yeah, I don't like that machine. They didn't destroy that machine. That machine is out there lurking.
Maybe they made some tweaks. They sent it back to the shop. I don't know.
I need to know that they treated it like the printer or the fax machine in Office Space.
Yes.
Is that too old of a reference now?
It's pretty old.
Yeah, I know. Because that movie came out, what, like 1999?
Yeah, Michael Bolton smashing the printer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe too long. All right, quick break. Let's come back.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, we're going to wrap this up with tinfoil hat time. We buried it till the very end. So
you're forcing me to the mic.
Because, here's the thing. I love, this show is now, what did we decide to call it?
Conspiracy Corner.
No, that's wrong. It was something else. We already said we can't have Conspiracy Corner because Bill Simmons does Parent Corner, and so that had to be out. It's something else.
Or the Conspiracy Crew. I kind of
know that's a good one.
Alliteration,
but
right?
Yeah, it is. But it was a fake alliteration.
No.
Anyway, it was something. It was a word with a K. And so, anyway, who
this
cares?
This is really good.
Yeah, this is great. This is really great. This is really great.
Can I talk yet?
I knew Armin was going to say the wrong one too. That was the worst part. Is I was like, I know he's going to turn on the mic and do the wrong one, and it's just going to completely derail me. But this show loves a good conspiracy, and so you have a Votto conspiracy. So share. So explain.
A little curious, don't you think, that Joey Votto appears in one spring training game for the Blue Jays, sees one pitch in one at-bat, hits a home run, and then, he did play the field, but then immediately steps on a bat, and, like, we don't have any details about the bat, and everyone's just like, yeah, it's the bat. He stepped on a bat.
No, what's the more famous thing now, the bat that Joey Votto stepped on or the sprinkler Marcus Stroman stepped on?
And, Michael Saunders also had some weird spring training injury too.
And,
weren't they going to sue
Robbie Ray fell down the stairs.
Meiser Asteris. We never saw Meiser Asteris because he fell down the stairs.
Yeah.
So I guess it's possible, but it's like the circumstances.
Falling down the stairs is the funniest way a pro athlete.
Clint Barmas fell down the stairs cleaning.
DJ.
What?
Dustin Johnson. That's the most famous falling down the stairs.
Clint Barbus was carrying meat downstairs as a member of the Colorado Rockies.
That's a great name, Clint Barbus.
Yeah.
Anyways, get into your conspiracy theory.
I don't know. It's a little weird, don't you think, that like the most notable thing that happened to the Blue Jays was this Joey Votto thing, and we get the incredible moment of his first plate appearances, again, first pitch, home run, and then immediately
gone.
Has this bizarro injury, and immediately we're told no big deal, like day off tomorrow, he'll be in probably the next day. Not only did he not appear in another spring training game, there was a week and a half, 2 weeks left of spring training. Like, what's he doing? Yeah. Like, what is,
he's
where,
at the games.
Where is he?
As a fan. You watch.
I mean, would that be not a nice capper on your career to at least say that, yeah, you gave your hometown fans one final moment, one glimmer of hope that you could be a factor for them in the season? I'm just, it's very strange. All I'm saying is
where are you saying? You're dancing around it. Say the take.
I mean, I don't know that somebody is not being honest with us here, that maybe he was never in the plans to play for this. This is all.
You're going the other way. I thought this was because part of my Vogelbach thing is that all they're doing with Joey Votto is making sure that he's healthy. And basically the second that he is, they're going to be like, hey, Daniel, enjoy the Cincinnati Reds stint.
That's not a conspiracy theory. That seems like pretty clear. Like
but your conspiracy theory.
I mean, it's very strange. So it's a real conspiracy theory. It's like, oh, here's your candy. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's not that good. It's like hard candy. It's like the ribbon candy, but it's like, it's candy.
No, ribbon candy is not candy.
It's candy. But that's it. And we've heard the last of Joey Votto's. I don't believe this, but it's like, it's very bizarre, the messaging and the lack of information we have about the details of the Joey Votto thing.
Yeah. That's an interesting, because I was actually going to say, is he the team's future bat? Is he the Jays' future bench bat, or is he the Jays' mascot? Is he now competing with Ace for where you show up, they're both dancing on top of the dugout, doing the Let's Go Blue Jay song? What's more likely? Is he in the dugout or on top?
Again, if my conspiracy theory is correct, on top. Yeah,
he's on top of the dugout.
Yeah. It's a
doing
not
his TikTok,
I'm
doing
just,
his TikTok dances.
We're just joking around. It's a couple of guys just shooting it, right?
Yeah.
But is it not really weird? Like, if I just laid out those cases, like Blue Jays with this super underwhelming offseason. Yeah. Joey Votto signed to a minor league deal.
I would say it's weird.
One at bat, one pitch, home run, stepped on a bat.
Oh, so
never seen from again.
So you're saying it's like
they made
shoot
it
around,
up.
You finish on a shot, and you're like, he just wanted to finish his career on a shot, but it's a spring shot?
But, I mean, it's better than looking like you can't play anymore at the major league level. At least it's an upbeat.
I'm giving this conspiracy two thumbs up.
Yeah?
I like it. Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot because it's a total zag. I didn't think about it at all. I think it's a good one, especially from you because you're, you know, his number one cheerleading fan. You watch his TikToks and you're like,
no.
He's like, I hate Canada. You're like, me too. That's it. Anyways, we got to go. Quick break. Then it's Luke Gazdick. Tried to have this guy on last week, but he did Hockey Night in Canada and now he's like super Hollywood. He's like, talk to my agent. It's Luke Gazdick, former NHL forward, NHL and Sportsnet. What's up, brother? How are we doing?
That is untrue.
Are we calling you from the Ritz? Like, where do they put you up when you're here? Like, it's got to be nice living that life, eh?
Buddy, I'm Toronto born and bred, and raised. Yeah, yeah. I grew up in North York. I live here now.
Yeah.
Some stuff came up. Some stuff came up last week, buddy.
Are you like, so you see Drake get his mail? Like, what is that like? Is that must be cool.
Oh, no chance, buddy. I'm a man of the people here.
Hey,
I'm one of the guys here.
Okay. So I do need to ask you that though. That is, you know, because you are a Toronto born bred guy and because, you've had the media rise that, you know, you've had recently, that had to be just a cool moment getting Hockey Night and saying like, holy crap, I'm on the panel of Hockey Night in Canada. That's the different thing. Like that's the top of the top. That's the creme de la creme.
It was really cool, man. Honestly, like, I grew up here as a kid in Toronto watching Hockey Night on Saturday nights. Obviously a big Leafs fan growing up. I had gotten a couple calls earlier in the year from the higher ups at Sportsnet to do, you know, Monday night hockey and Wednesday night hockey. And then I got to do my first Leaf game, which I thought was really cool. And I had to ask my boss a couple times to make sure he was asking me to do hockey night. I didn't really believe it.
You're like, yeah, man, to clean up after. You are here. We needed you to clean the set.
It was great timing that it was Leafs Oilers. Like, yeah. I just feel like the stars just aligned. And honestly, it was just a really cool experience. It's still a couple weeks later. I'm still kind of soaking it in. But it was definitely just a really cool thing, man. My first hockey, my first NHL game was on Hockey Night Canada. So it was cool to be on the panel. Pretty surreal.
Mm-hmm. No, that's it, man. I know you're a guy who puts the work in. And I've went, oh, that's cool. He's you're a guy who gets it. And I felt like, yeah, that moment for you, you were like, nah, I get this. This is really cool to have. And so, yeah, it was a fun watch. You did a great job. Okay, so I got a take for you after this weekend because I want to talk to you about a bunch of things. But I was thinking about it with the crowd that was in Buffalo Saturday night for the Leafs. It's just, it's a rowdy crowd. It's a loud crowd. Obviously, it's a bunch of people that usually turn it into, hey, we're going to booze and go down and turn this thing into a party. But it's the we want 60 chance and the real atmosphere. And it got me sort of thinking about how we always talk about Toronto's home crowd, and is it the worst? Is it the best? Is it sometimes a morgue? And yeah, it's not a great crowd. There's absolutely no way of defending it because it is so expensive to get into the arena. And yeah, at times there's a real lack of energy, even in big spots. You look back at some of the old crowds and you go, damn, that's crazy. It was a madhouse in there. I wonder if that's actually one of the toughest disadvantages of this market is like if guys could have played in front of those kind of fans, the real fans that want to be in the building every night, if there would have been more of a connection with some of the players to the actual fan base. Am I explaining that right? Like I feel like it's something I'm sort of just coming up with. I'm trying to kind of workshop it, but that's part of the disconnect that we have is now more than ever, the players that play for the Leafs don't get a good enough look or a good enough feel of what this team actually means to the city, especially if you're not from here, because of who they're playing in front of.
No, I think you explained it pretty well. This is kind of one of the things I explained to Simone Benoit. I had him on my podcast a couple months ago. He was my last episode. And, you know, he obviously grew up in Quebec, spent his NHL time down in SoCal. And one of the questions I asked him, I prefaced it with almost exactly what you were saying, was that this is a more white-collar town, I guess you could call it, but a town that certainly embraces its blue-collar players. I prefaced him with guys like Tucker and Roberts and Domi. Like that's the era I grew up with in the early 2000s, and how the town just falls in love with guys like you, Benny, as I was talking to him, guys that play hard and wear their heart on their sleeve, and trying to get that point across to him. I think you are right to a certain extent in that tune because I don't know, maybe it's fallen off a bit here in Toronto that there has been a little bit of a disconnect, but it's still, I mean, it's still a great hockey town. I just wish the atmosphere was truly a little better in there some nights. Going from town to town playing in the NHL, enter some really, really special buildings where you truly feel that connection. I mean, a place like Nashville, Tennessee comes to mind for me, where every time we went in there, it was just like, it was just incredible. The reaction and the way they take in hockey and watch hockey was special. I understand that's like a country town that is new to hockey, but you just see it differently in the rinks you go across as you play.
Yeah, I'm not trying to split the atom here. I know this has been like a widely discussed thing of, hey, how does Toronto get a better crowd? Because it is. It's a corporate crowd. And it's a quiet crowd a lot of nights. It can get loud in there. Sometimes I think that they're just an easy, soft target for everybody else to make fun of. But no, you watch Calgary games, for example, right? It feels like a madhouse in there. Montreal, they have Bell Center. You go there for a hockey game and it feels as though you're like breathing the game as a fan in the stands. And then there's some buildings that just don't have energy or a real attitude to them. And Toronto is, I'm sorry, it's one of them. When you're in the rink, there isn't a feeling of like, holy crap, there's a buzz in here. There's a real electricity to being at this game. It can heat up if it's like, you know, overtime or like a big spot, a big moment, a tight game at the end. You'll get it. You'll get the odd go Leafs go chance, but it's not crazy. And I think that for the players now, the kind of thing that I'm certain trying to drive at is you understand that this is a good hockey town. I don't think anybody that would be on the team would ever misunderstand how many people care about the team just by like the breadth of the media, any type of public appearances they do, their level of fame as hockey players compared to everywhere else. Like, I got cousins from California, and I was talking to them yesterday, and it just happened to come up where I was like, oh, do you know any hockey players? They don't have a clue who Sidney Crosby is. They have zero idea who Alex Ovechkin is, Connor McDavid. Those people do not exist in their orbit. These are people from SoCal. So you have this fame, and if you look on social media, you see the amount of people who are passionate about it and who are talking to you. But being at the game, it just felt special looking at that Saturday night of all the people going, you know, crazy for this team, the people chanting for this team, the reactions from the players. And I went, that sucks that you guys never really get that element of it, that you never get to feel the connection of when you're on the ice, how rabid and passionate and crazy and fun this fan base is. And I feel like if they would have been able to tap into it somehow, it actually would have added a lot to this group from the heart and soul passion quotient that we get sometimes. Is like when we criticize those players for the way that they play or that they don't care enough, I think that maybe there is a part of that that is the building that they play in and the fans that they're in front of every night.
No, I agree, man. And listen, like, beginning of periods, one of the most frustrating things, obviously, probably for those players. Yeah. And watching on TV is seeing the entire Platinum section empty basically until the 15-minute mark coming back in. But I mean, I think the guys do know and appreciate it. Like, they go across the league. Like, when I played in Edmonton, when the Leafs come there, it's packed with Leafs fans, right? Yeah. Like, their fans travel better than maybe any fan base in hockey. Montreal's probably up there as well, but they travel well. But you're certainly right, man. I didn't really even think about that until maybe after the first in the Buffalo game on Saturday, where I was just like, wow, this is awesome. Like, these guys are going nuts. It's honestly, it is frustrating. Like, and I've played in the rink, I've played games there, and now watching it, it's just, after a while, you're like, can we, you know, maybe do something about this? But I think you really can. I think the guys know that this fan base is loyal. It's just tough as ever to get inside that building.
Yeah, I guess to summarize it and I'll move on, It reminded me of what an advantage we should have here. You know, like, home ice advantage should matter more because, and you see it with those Leafs road games. Those are some of the best games. The Western Canadian road trips that the Leafs do, Edmonton, Calgary, and Vancouver specifically, that's as fun as it can be in a building. When you're at a Montreal and a Leafs game, that is as fun as it gets. There is just people talking trash. It's electric in there. And Toronto doesn't have that electricity like some of the other Canadian markets can tap into. And that's one of the kind of drags of, I'm not trying to make excuses for the players. Again, that's what the money's for. You got to be able to find ways to get up for these games and to play with passion, all that different stuff. But it's so much that it should be a major advantage. It should be one of the reasons why it's like guys want to play here. And at the end of the day, it's like you don't see the people that you're ultimately really playing for on a night in, night out. Like, you're not tapping into that when you go down to the arena. Anyway, so I'll move on. I did want to talk to you about, actually, I'll do Matthews first. So he hit 60. You saw the reaction from his team and what it meant to him. Do you think they, like, where are you at in terms of him trying to hit 70? Because Samsonov brought it up after the game. And Tavares downplayed it and went, hey, I don't think that that's something that he's like hyper-focused on. I know that they're trying to win. But if you're in that room and he actually has like an outside chance to close in on it, how do you handle that from a team standpoint? How do you handle it if you're him, knowing that that big number is sitting kind of right there, something that people will remember forever? But, you know, you do have potentially some load management coming up, a couple tough series. It's sort of interesting, like, the import that they put on it.
Yeah. I mean, if I was in the room, I'd be just sitting there with wide eyes, watching goal at a time go through. And I mean, I'd be wanting to see as many as I could, but yeah. I understand that this team has greater aspirations. He'll downplay it, and I think guys always do, but man, would it ever be special? And I think it's like it's become real. I think even when we talked about it, you know, call it a month ago, 2 months ago, is he going to get to 70 this year? No one really knew if that was a realistic thing. I think people were taking takes at it and guesses. But I mean, this is a realistic number that could be hit. And I think that his teammates are obviously watching and observing this closely and seeing it become something that is very, very cool. But for Austin, like, I think you're bang on with like the load management. Like I think towards the end, we might be seeing the playoffs start to get set, especially coming up against a team maybe in Florida where you're going to want to have your guys take a couple nights. So, you know, a night here, a night off. But honestly, like if I was in that dressing room and on that team, I'd be wanting to see 70 for sure. Like I'd be wanting him to take a crack at it. But I don't know. They usually downplay it, and I'm sure Austin will do the same. He'll talk about how it's not that important, but I bet you it's probably in the back of his mind.
So this is the thing is, I really do feel like one of the most important pieces to the Leafs having an identity is those moments where Matthews scores and he shows that level of just passion for goal scoring, right? Like the big, massive fist bump for 60, the way his teammates responded. When he's scoring goals, you feel like the Leafs are this unstoppable juggernaut, right? Like look at the winning streak they had this year that sort of turned everybody around in terms of where they were at. It's because Matthews was like ripping hat tricks and two goal nights and you went, oh my God, how many goals does he have in the last seven games, right? And so having him continue that streak or, you know, get closer to 70, I actually will help the team kind of stay engaged down the stretch run. Like it's something to keep them to avoid complacency, but it's also got to be a little bit difficult for them because if they put it sort of publicly like that they're chasing this or it looks like they're chasing it too hard, then people are going to criticize them for overly emphasizing it. Like it actually just, it's, I'm probably making too big of a deal of it, but it does feel like they've kind of got to thread the needle here on what they're doing because, yeah, 10 goals for Matthews in 9 games is not a crazy number. And I wonder what it would look like if they're going into the final game of the season and he's a goal off or 2 goals off and what the decision would be on the second half of a back-to-back. Because there's a bit of an element at play here of, remember when, are you a football fan? Do you remember when the Colts sat Peyton Manning when they could have gone 16-0?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a little bit of that to me is the Colts sit Peyton Manning and then they ended up losing and all the guys in their locker room go, hey, who won the Super Bowl 2 years ago? I don't remember, but do you remember who went 16-0? The 72 Dolphins. Everybody knows it. Scoring 70 goals, like you never forget that.
No, and I think you're in the right way here when you talk about how, and I know it sounds bigger than it is, but like the team will play so much better as he's chasing this. And I think it goes understated. You talked about the reaction that he did when he scored, but also with his team. Like, I think it's understated how much that can power a team and motivate like a team. Like for me, as I was like a depth guy, fourth line guy, it didn't matter lower down the lineup. When you see, you know, emotion from a top player like that, who usually doesn't show a ton. Like you see so many goals this year where he scores and it's just like another thing. But a goal like that on Saturday where he is just like blatantly, you know, showing this like true heart and emotion, like that really, really powers and leads a team. Like it's usually one to two players on every team that when they're going, it just seems like everyone just jumps on. And that's like, that's the Leafs right there. I mean, Connor's an easy one to use in Edmonton. Like when he's going, the rest of the team is. But when you have a player that is going as well as Austin is, the rest of the guys just follow. Mm-hmm. And it's such a powerful thing to have. I think when he is going for something like this, it just brings up the energy level and the compete level of everyone else around him. Like you could see the way the team's playing as he's been chasing this thing is just better and better. So I think it's a great thing for him to continue to chase it. The team will only play better.
I'm with you. I think we're kind of conditioned to the idea of we're over the regular season statistics for this core, right? Whenever they flash up a number of, oh, and then they've passed this guy. It's like most people go that are hardcore fans, hey, just show up when it matters and do these things in the postseason. But to me, I think maybe we've discounted a little bit of what it would mean to the team to have Matthews continue to try to close in on this. Him staying in that mentality of, oh man, I got to score. I want to score. I'm so hungry for goal scoring. And then bleeding over into the postseason, what a hot stretch run could be for these guys. And I'm not buying as much this year. The idea of they're going to burn out. It is quite a few games down the stretch, which is a little interesting. Like they're playing these 9 games, all of them until like now the 17th, right? So that's a lot. Like that's a heavy workload. I just don't want to get too obsessive with the load management stuff versus the actual, yeah, team bonding slash engagement quotient that you're going to get from him chasing the streak. So yeah, you mentioned it. You know Benoit. He's a guy you played with in the AHL. He gets his contract. I liked it. I thought, man, I was actually a little surprised. Benoit almost didn't want to roll the dice and see how things landed for him, but I guess he likes Toronto. The book on him was always that, like, he's a real crazy gym rat guy, that he's just like a physical fitness dude that kind of dominates those areas. But yeah, how do you think this is going to age for him, this contract? Like, what kind of guy he is? Sort of surprising, though, that he ended up here, right? Given, like, the way his season started.
Yeah, I mean, I like the deal for both sides. And I think with players like this, especially that have never come into any contract or money like this, like, guys love location and they love stability. Mm. Stability is the number one, right? Like, you can choose to test the market, but that's what he did last year. And I understand his value was higher right now than it probably ever was, but he ends up taking that 1 year minimum deal for Toronto. But I just look at the player and this is like, I don't want to say this is a special one for me, but this is really cool. Like, I watched him turn pro his first 2 years pro in San Diego. He went into Anaheim basically on a tryout, ends up signing an AHL deal with San Diego and just continued to work. We had an assistant coach down there, former Leaf, Sylvain Lefebvre, who took care of the D, ran most of the penalty killing, and him and Benny worked every day, like before practice, after practice, probably I'm talking 20, 30, 40, whatever it was, minutes worth of drills, edges, hands, point shots, you name it. This guy did that every day for like 2 years. Ends up getting his chance in Anaheim and, I mean, gets here. And I think that's the most special part about this is if you don't make the team out of camp or if you get injured in camp, it is so hard to get back up. Like, A, something has to happen up top. There has to be injuries, sickness, whatever it is. You also have to be playing really good at that time to get that opportunity. And then you have to make the most of that opportunity. It is just, in my 11 years of pro hockey, it is one of the toughest things to do. It's tough because young kids would ask me, like, if they don't make the team at a camp, the big club, like, am I going to be down here for the year? And I'd always say, no, just keep working. Like, you know, you'll get your shot. But it is really one of the toughest things is to get back to the big club after not making it in camp. And he did that. Like, he goes and, you know, has to play a bit in the AHL with the Marlies, but then comes back up, gets his opportunity. You're going to play a couple minutes, probably no special teams, maybe a little bit of penalty kill. It's not easy for a blue collar player like that to make his mark and let it be known that he deserves to be there with not a ton of opportunity. And I feel like he just did that. And when I talked to him before I interviewed him too, we were just kind of texting and I just, you know, make sure you're playing the same way. And then when I sat down with him for the pod, like I told you, I was like, just play, continue playing the way you're playing. Just finish all your checks. If you have to fight, go fight. You don't have to be a tough guy, but make sure if you throw a big hit and someone challenges you, don't say no. And just, you don't have to chip in offensively, but just keep it as simple as possible and use your wheels and all that. And I think this is a great signing for them. Like, on a consistent basis, to me, he's been one of their most consistent defenders. And I understand he doesn't bring you a lot offensively, but not every defenseman has to. Everybody plays a role. And I think the deal is great for both sides. I mean, you're right. He probably could have explored the UFA market, but like I said, man, when guys are in that position and you like the place you're playing, you like your teammates, you like the future of the team, and you have some stability, like, it's hard to turn down deals like that.
Okay, yeah, that's it. And this is the other part too. And I know McMahon's deal was only 2 years, but what is your read on the level of import of having guys like that who, you know, it removes the mercenary part of the Leafs, where now they've got some guys who are depth players who got to where they are by being consistent and working hard, who they reward with contracts, but now are not just here for the next season, that they're here for the next few.
I love that. Honestly, McMahon's such a good story too. And on Hockey Night, I prefaced my question to him post game with the fact that he played in the ECHL. And I mean, it gets a laugh every now and then, but anyone that's played or watched, or more specifically played in the ECHL, understands that it's an absolute jungle down there. Mm-hmm. And I made the joke on TV that my captain, my veteran, when I got there, I was sitting right beside this guy that had been in the league for 8 years. He said the ECHL stands for easy come, hard to leave. Like anyone can get to the coast post college, getting sent down, called up from the SP or some other league. Like it's not a very hard league to get into, but once you get labeled as an East Coast League hockey player, it is one of the toughest leagues and positions to get out of. And I have a lot of respect for anyone that can climb out of that and not only get yourself to the American League, but then get your foot in the door in the show and do what Bobby McMahon has done. That rubs off on guys in the locker room, like guys like Bobby and Simone. I can tell you like that attitude doesn't just start with games. Like that will be an everyday practice mentality. That is guys that are there that don't take the opportunity for granted, even though they've signed a contract and have stability. Every day is still a test and an opportunity for them. Mm-hmm. They know that just because they have a contract, it's not exactly job security. They can be in the American League tomorrow, right? And I think that attitude rubs off on everybody in the dressing room. And I think the more guys they, you know, continue to surround the top guys and, you know, the rest of the team in the core with guys like this, it's never a bad thing.
Well, I mean, this is kind of, like, I don't want to overstate this because I do think that that's just the NHL, is that if you work your ass off and you perform well, somebody's going to pay you. But I do like that there is something with the Leafs that they've had that now internally, where they brought in two guys, and then before the season was even up, they offered them an opportunity to make money and be rewarded for the seasons that they had. And so if you're looking at guys who are going to be coming up, and if you're another player who gets their opportunity with the Maple Leafs and is in a similar spot or a similar role, I got to think that there's at least a bit of an added feeling now looking around the room and seeing guys that have that reward, that we're able to accomplish that, and knowing, hey, if I just keep it simple, Benoit is not the toughest guy, and I don't think that he's an enforcer by any stretch, but it's like the willingness to fight is what I like about him, right? It's not that he's going out looking for it, but he's willing. He'll give you one. The willingness to finish a check, the willingness to play hard. Those things are now relatable to other guys who get their crack on this Leafs team, knowing that there could be some permanence to you that you could be around and that this team will be interested in what you're doing from a financial standpoint.
No, and knowing that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, if mm-hmm. you're working towards your goals, you can see a guy with a realistic look at that right across the dressing room,
yep.
you know, in Bobby and guys like Simone, and, you know, things like blocking shots are not fun things to do, that these guys have gone out every night, and it will rub off not only on the team, but throughout the organization that, hey, maybe this is a message from Brad, right? Up top, that if you play the right way and maybe setting a bit of a tone and changing a bit of this, you know, Leafs culture and attitude, that if you play the right way, there's a reward to be had. And I think that's a really good thing for players.
Okay. So, actually I got one other thing on the contracts. Bertuzzi lately has been playing quite good. He's scoring goals, and some of it is just like positive regression. And Keefe even mentioned it the other day, where he's like, yeah, he couldn't buy one earlier in the year, and now he's scoring from, you know, behind the net. Do you think that he's someone that should also be a long-term piece with this team? Like, is he a mercenary for you, where you're saying, yep, you'd want to get as much out of this playoff run as you can, but unrealistic that you're giving him money? Or is he someone that the more you see with this team, you're thinking, nah, that actually might be the next guy that you want to try and get done?
I like Bert. I obviously had a tough start to the year, couldn't buy a goal like you just said, but Mark Bergevin had a great quote that I reheard the other day. He said, some players get you to the playoffs, some players get you through the playoffs. And I feel like Bert is a guy that towards, you know, the dog days here, the harder the game gets, like the better Bert has been. Some guys are just like that, right? When I don't want to say when there's nothing on the line earlier in the year, he reminds me a bit of Patty Maroon, who I played with in Edmonton, mm-hmm. who he would disappear for games and stretches, and it was frustrating. And I think I don't want to say the work ethic was always a question, but you knew when there was a big game and the harder the game got, you knew he was going to be there for you. And mm-hmm. that's what I've respected about Bert, is that the tougher the game has got, Morbert has stepped up. And I don't know if we're talking long term here, but if they can get something done with him on, you know, maybe a shorter, call it two or three. I know, you know, the injury stuff is always a factor there, but Bert's a guy I want on my team. And I think he's shown that through the last little bit. It'll be big to see how he finishes the season and how his playoffs go. But for me, he's been one of the guys that, that I've enjoyed watching and would say that I would love to have on my team going forward.
So I mentioned there's 9 games in 17 days to close the season for Leafs, and there's 2 back-to-backs that they still have left. So Wohl's going to get a chance to play, but it really did feel like Saturday night was a significant moment for Samsonov, especially returning after there was like some questions and Wohl got 3 games. And to me, it's like, it feels like a lot of people still want Wohl to be the guy because there is that underlying lack of trust for Samsonov. But this is a 2-parter. One is, do you think that he has now pulled away with this job? And 2 is, how many games are you giving him down the stretch here? Like, are you giving him a real significant, like say like 6 of the 9 games go to Samsonov at this point, because you've got to determine that he's now the guy for the postseason, at least to start?
Yeah, this is an interesting one because Sammy has definitely pulled away. Man, did he have a good night in Buffalo on Saturday. And for me, it was always Joe Wohl. Like, that was always the thought in the back of my mind, was that this is Wohl's job, more so to lose. And I think you brought a good point about Sammy, even as well as he's playing, you always have that thought in the back of your mind that, you know, of what happened kind of earlier this year and that there is a bit of an instability. But I mean, the worst thing that could probably happen for this team is that Joe Wohl starts playing incredible right now, and now you have an even bigger decision on your hands. He'll definitely play the 2 games in the back-to-backs. But for me, it's been Sammy, and it's just been such a good story throughout the year, obviously, of where he's come from and what he's turned this season into. And the end of the day, these goalies will dictate who plays, and I just feel like Sammy's earned this. Up till now, he's shown that he's the guy, and the guys love playing in front of him. Like, when he is going and he is making big saves, I think it just means that much more for the guys in front of him. Like, you can just see the reactions and the emotion, kind of like Matthews we talked about earlier. Like, they want to see him succeed just as bad as he wants to succeed. And he gives them a boost that I'm not saying Joe Wohl doesn't, but for me right now, you ride the hot hand, and Sammy's earned this. Sammy has full on board earned this, and I think it is his job now. I think with Wohl, you give him a couple more till the end of the year. But Sammy's earned earned everything he's got for the time being.
Yeah, I'm with you, man. Luke, thanks for making time today, brother. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Take care, buddy. Luke Gazdik, former NHL forward, NHL and Sportsnet. No, a guy who's talking in Canada. Okay, so here's my thoughts on the Samsonov thing. I kind of alluded to it a bit there. Everyone had the underlying feeling of this was going to be Wohl's job. And even when Samsonov was hot, you look at the majority of people, and myself included in this, by the way, like, you know, I know that I said very early in his run that this was going to be a goalie battle, and a lot of people dismissed me on that. And people were like, you're crazy. Wohl is a way better goaltender. Wohl is 100% the guy. Look at Samsonov, save percentage over the course of the year, like blah, 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 blah. And people like kept that hard line position. I went, I don't know. He did win them a playoff series last year, and he has been good, and he has looked better, and they win hockey games with him in the net. So it's got to be a battle. But I said at the time it was going to be 60-40 Wohl, because organizationally, he had the backing of the team. And every smart person, everyone that has any type of real connection to the team, knew that this was going to be the case. And even like when we talked to guys like Kevin Woodley and other goaltending, like former goaltenders or current, like guys who have coached the position, know the position, play the position, they said the same thing. This Wohl is technically superior, and his analytics are spectacular. There's a calmness to his game. He's going to be the better goalie. I never viewed the separation as that significant between the two guys. I just thought at some point the push that Wohl was going to get and his pedigree and ability was going to end up giving him the slight edge. And he hasn't done anything wrong. Like, he had the one bad game last week. Fine, it's his worst game as a Leaf. He hasn't played poorly. He's played well. But Samsonov has outperformed him.
He looks better. And there was another shaky moment where Samsonov leaves that game against Edmonton where they're falling apart at the very end of the game, and he leaves with a calf contusion or whatever the hell it ended up being with his leg, where he says he slid in the post and he got hurt. And it comes right after he leaves practice with an injury thing. And whenever this happens with Samsonov, you start to get nervous. You start to get sweaty and say, oh no, here it is, here it is, here it is. Because we're all waiting for the other shoe to drop with him. And we all have been the entire stretch run that he's had. Every bad game he's had, every underwhelming goal that he's let in, people are immediately snapping to go, oh, there it is, here it is, now it's happening, now it's happening, now it's happening. And it's a defense mechanism that you have as a fan for the most part, but it's something that is based in reality with him. But I think we are now at a point where there's no more sharing the net. That was the big statement from Saturday. Sharing the net is done. It is now Samsonov's net, and you're giving Joe Woll, to me, max three more games. Max three. You're giving him, obviously, the Devils game on the 9th, the second half of a back-to-back, and you're giving him the final game of the season, the 17th against Tampa, and you're probably, depending on the playoff matchup, maybe, I don't know, but one of those two games, like Samsonov 16, 17, one of those two, I think that he should play. And then Woll will get one of them. I'm not sure which one, but as of right now, this is the way I feel. I think that Samsonov, barring disaster, should play the next four games. Tonight, against Florida, obviously. Wednesday against Tampa, trying him out there. Saturday night against Montreal, and then Monday against Pittsburgh. Those next four games should be Samsonov's net. You should be basically saying, the goaltending battle is over. You're getting the game one starting job, with the understanding that this is a happy thing. That if Samsonov does falter, if Samsonov does fail, if he turns out to be, the clock strikes midnight and he turns out to be a fraud and the postseason he has a bad game, that the organization's going to feel comfortable going to Woll, and that he is a much better option than what they've had in years past. So ultimately a good thing. But to me, no more splitting the net. Samsonov just won the job. At least he won the job to prove himself down the stretch run and get the vast majority of the games. And that's where I think we're at here. Ilya Samsonov, come on down. All right, set a quick break and then hit what we missed.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
I'm so grateful that I get to do what I do. I was talking with the guys before show last week about how if I retired, if I won the lottery, if I fell into money, if it turned out that I had a great uncle who was a lord, and he left me an estate, I was like, oh, crap, that I would still just end up watching sports and talking about them with my friends. Like, there wouldn't be a... I would travel. I would do a lot of things. I'd have a life that's much more luxurious than the one that I have now. But at the end of the day, I would still be texting Ennis angry Blue Jay songs as they, as Justin Turner starts the season with another out. And I went, oh no, this is before yesterday. Like, that's what I'll be doing. Reactionary thoughts to sporting events. And I would want to end up doing this stuff anyway. But I have no idea how I'm going to manage the next couple. Like, I don't know how I've ever managed this before. Like, how anyone manages this. It's like, the Final Four, we got Major League Baseball, we've got, bless the Raptors for just completely taking a knee on me having to pay attention to what's, like, this is the first time since I've done the job where I've just stopped watching the Raptors entirely. Like, I've just stopped. There's no point. What am I going to do? I got to conserve my time and energy. Like, there's nothing to pay attention to. They are moribund. It's horrific. I'll tune in. I'll look at the scores. And I even saw last night, I ended up actually having the TV. I was watching Sunday Night Baseball, again, watching the Dodgers crush. And it just came on. It was like the Raptors replay. I think I switched it onto a TV. And I was like kind of glancing up as the Raptors replay. And I went, oh, yeah, you guys. Right. I think the last full game I watched was the one that I was at where Shea was here on the Friday. I was like, okay, yeah. But yeah, now Leafs, and we're entering the Stanley Cup playoffs, which is the best time of the year. I'm ramping up watching the NBA because I want to know. Like yesterday, there was a ton of NBA games that like really mattered. So I'm sitting there going, oh, I kind of want to tune into a bunch of these. We've got the women's tournament tonight where there's like a slate of games, like two games that are incredibly important that I really want to watch. There's a lot right now. There's a lot. This is strap in and get ready. It's the best. It is the best. It is the best, best, best. I don't know if it's better than the fall.
You said last week it was. I was listening and
I know. I go back and forth because here's the truth of the matter is like, I don't think that there's anything I get more excited for the arrival of than football because football just matters so much more when it starts. And then October baseball, like fall playoff baseball, I deeply love it. And then like the other sports starting is great and getting ready for the other sports to return and have that full slate it's just fun. But football, there's something about the start of NFL where you're like, this is the best. And then postseason baseball is so great.
Is postseason baseball, you like it more than postseason NHL? Pretty close.
So here's the thing with postseason NHL. I really love the first round. I always have. The first round of Stanley Cup Finals is incredible. Once it gets deeper, I find year over year, it's too often where teams that aren't special get a hot goalie or get a hot run or timely goal scoring and they end up like, you know, I don't care. Like when Montreal went from the COVID season the COVID season before that when it was the Dallas Stars. There just ends up being a lot of years where the teams aren't sterling and spectacular sometimes late. There always feels like a fraud team that makes it. And you're like, come on.
It's kind of happening with MLB now too. No.
Yeah. That's the thing I'm scared about with baseball, to be honest, is like, and I was actually going to mention that fall takes a hit because now you get Arizona Diamondbacks through there who win 84 games. And I'm like, no, I don't want this. Or that Jays team that felt horrible all year and they make it and you go, no. These teams aren't supposed to be there. I love the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. I'd love to see the Leafs actually make a deep run. I'd love to see a bunch of the Canadian teams actually be in the mix, you know, later. That always gauges and keeps my interest more. Some of the like special teams. It's harder too as a Leaf fan because, you know, you've got like the Panthers and the Bruins who are very, very good teams that you're not as invested in watching because you do just like hate them and you don't want to see them go on to have success. NBA is the opposite where early NBA playoffs, I normally don't care. And I kind of usually write that off and say, I'll catch you in the second round. This year is going to be different. This year,
West Coast, at least.
West Coast is going to be phenomenal out of the gate. Mm-hmm. Like, you look at what some of these matchups could be.
Everyone is a toss-up almost.
No.
Yeah. The Lakers will beat the T-Wolves. If we make it through the play-in.
No, here's what I promise you about the NBA standings is that the Nuggets are going to eviscerate whoever they play.
Agreed.
I think, the T-Wolves are very shaky. Like, they could actually lose to, like, I like the T-Wolves, and I think that they got something, and, you know, they're going to be a really interesting story. But, yeah, if you're telling me, like, who are the teams that you are the most confident in right now in the Western Conference, OKC still has the prove-it factor. But I think that the Nuggets are 100% going to win their series. And I also think that the Mavs are going to 100% win their series.
No matter who they play, the Mavs.
Yeah, pretty much. In the first round, I think
Clippers. They got the Clippers right now.
Yeah, the Clippers suck.
Yeah, they fell off.
Yeah, the Clippers suck. And the Mavs are red hot. And I just feel like Luka has unlocked something recently. He's added a little bit of... And Kyrie, like, there's just a more of a synergy to that Mavs team. I feel more confident about... It's funny, when the Mavs came to town, I actually did a segment. I don't know if I talked about it on air, it was just a private thought, but I think I had a guest on and asked them why I could just never feel great about the Mavs when Luka's so great, and then they finally get Kyrie, and there was pieces around them that I liked, and they added Derek Lively, and they still have Hardaway coming off the bench, giving them good heat check stuff, and I liked the trade that they made at the deadline, and I went, why does it still feel so incomplete? Why do I not feel like they're contenders? And now... After watching them play Denver in that game, and I know Kyrie hit that incredible shot, but I went, man, you know, they do have the offense that can just play anybody, and they have that crunch time scoring. And you think about this watching March Madness right now specifically is when the games get late, and I saw in that Duke game against NC State, and it ended up being a blowout, so who cares? But my first uh-oh for Duke in that game was DJ Burns could score with ease, mm-hmm. and Duke didn't have anybody that was getting easy offense or as easy offense, not even close. Duke missed a bunch of threes, but DJ Burns, it was, you can give him the ball in the low block every single time. And that
white kid from Duke, their center. I can't remember.
Filipkowski?
No. Filipkowski was not defending him. It was the other guy that they brought in. But he just got, he's getting wrecked. And they're bringing doubles, and he can pass out of it, and he's hitting those little lefty shots. And I'm going,
I love watching.
I was like, I thought Duke's only path to win that game was to get DJ Burns to foul out. And I went, why aren't they going at him every single time? You got to just be posting up Filipowski, trying to get him to do different moves and hope that Brian Burns takes a swing or has an emotional moment. Because if he's in this down the stretch, you're dead meat. And that's how I feel about the Mavericks right now is I just think they're going to be able to get easy offense at the end of every single game. And if they can just hang around, only that Nuggets 1-2 combo of Murray and Jokic, that two-man game beats the Kyrie Luka two-man game. And so, yeah, ultimately, I think that's what it's going to come down to. But yeah, I love this time. And I know this is stupid to even be going over this, but yeah, just whew, so good. So incredibly good. I got to start getting into golf brain here a little bit too with, because golf is dead to me. Like now with Liv, it's like you can't split up and take a bunch of the top golfers I know and then try to get me to care about, like, great, Scottie Scheffler, I'll get up for the Masters. I'm going to get up for the majors the same way, but I've even as a guy who's not a primary golf fan, I've never felt as disconnected from, like, the tour as I do now. Like, I have no idea what's going on. Like, no idea. So this whole week has to be, like, I got to go to golf camp.
I was going to say, what would switch your mind? What would change your mind? Nothing, eh? It's done?
No, it's done. Liv's never going away, and, yeah, I didn't care about non-majors that much anyways, but at least I was following stories and like able to track it. And I cared more about the depth of the field. And yeah, you can't take away that many names to me and have them be playing on the other side of the planet on what YouTube streams or whatever the hell it is and get me to care. I'll care for the majors and I will. I will care deeply about the Masters. I will probably watch a copious amount of it as I always do, but I'll be deeply invested. I will deeply care. That's one of the things that I enjoy the most in all of sports is watching the Masters, even though I'm not a huge like golf guy in general. But yeah, no, it doesn't feel, I don't feel connected to it whatsoever. And I don't, if any league like this happened, like if the NBA lost 15% of their best players all of a sudden, and they went to go all play in Europe, I'd feel like, damn, the product is kind of watered down and the stories aren't nearly as interesting. And there's a lot of guys that I don't care about now that are a part of the league. So it's not just a golf thing. This would happen to anyone. It's part of the reason why I've never really been able to get into soccer is every league has stars, but they're not all concentrated in one spot. And I'm like, wait, I got to pay attention to all of these. Like, I can't do that. I'm out. Fair. I'm out. Yeah. I never was raised with a team. I'm out. Like, as someone on the outside, can't do it. Anyway.
And maybe that's why they're creating the European Super League, or they're trying to.
Yeah, I know. But I hate that because I don't, like, me as an outsider, it's like, I don't need it. Like, you guys care about it way more, hardcore soccer fans. And if it's going to hurt your product, I don't want it. Like, it's what I said to, how I felt about Sacramento Kings fans when I said, talk to Mike Bibby, is their fans were so incredible. They cared about basketball. Even me as a Sonics fan didn't want Sacramento to lose their basketball team because they care. I don't want that as a sports fan, some casual coming in being like, what's the Super League? Oh my God. So I can watch. No, that's stupid. Don't hurt it for the real fans. It's the same thing with like the NCAA tournament. If the idea is to continue to expand it or tinker with it or try to add more ways of making revenue off it, I'm like, no, let us have this. I don't care if more eyeballs come in on it. Like, it's fun to have people who enjoy it, but not at the expense of the heart and soul of it. And so the soccer one, as a sports purist, bothers me that they would try to bring me in on something over taking into account all the people that truly deeply care and support their clubs and have for generations. That's awful to me. Like, that's genuinely, that's as abhorrent of sports behavior as it gets. Don't do that stuff. Don't mess with success. Don't mess with the stuff that people care about the most. And yeah. Have allowed you to be even considering these kind of business moves because of those people. No. You know me, I'm for the fans. Anyway, subscribe to the podcast, leave 5 stars if you are a fan of the show. It always helps me out. Reach out on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus anytime. We'll be back tomorrow with Myrtle after big Leafs Panthers game tonight. Leafs Talk, subscribe and review.